you may have seen, is a member of the Queen City Podcast Network, powered by Ortho Carolina. Find out more at queencitypodcastnetwork.com.
Actors, right? The road to fame and celebrity. All right, I get it. You've had an incredible life.
Aren't you sick of hearing about them?
Me too.
The only problem is, I'm one of them. Except I'm not famous. Oh, you've probably seen me. A bunch of times. I'm the guy with the information about the hero's dad. I'm the doctor that can't figure out what's wrong with one of the main characters. I'm the guy they just punched in the face during the interrogation. My name's Brian LaFontaine, and I'm a professional actor. Oh, and it's not just me. There's a ton of us.
We're the ones you don't hear about.
Yeah, we're the names that scroll by at lightning speed during the end credits, but there's way more of us than there are of them. We're important too, dammit, because without us, they can't tell the rest of the story. So this is for all the movie and TV prostitutes, homeless people, drug dealers, cab drivers, cops numbers 2, 3, and sometimes 4, the pilots, the waitresses, and girl at party.
This is You May Have Seen. Today I'm talking with Lane Garrison. I'll be honest, Lane and I had never met before this interview, and this guy opened up and truly shared his life story with me, and for that I'm grateful. He's a phenomenal actor. I mean, he's Tweener from Prison Break. We talk about his true leading man debut in The Iron Orchard being released digitally on August 6th, so be sure to check that out. We talk about choosing to play golf in 106-degree heat and all kinds of other crazy stuff. Here's Lane Garrison.
I don't remember if I did or not. This is going really well so far. I send you information, you miss it. You send me information, I miss it. This is going to be an award winner.
I know, it's fine. It's all good. Well, but I mean, I have a baby upstairs, so I have dad brain.
Oh my gosh.
Like, I'm just trying to get through the day.
I was going
to
ask you about that. So you're a dad now. And I apologize. Is it a boy or a girl?
It's a little girl.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, little girl, Lyndon Rose, 10 months old.
So you're not sleeping at all.
I'm still not sleeping, no.
So Lane Garrison, where may we have seen you?
So you might have seen me, most people see me in Prison Break. That's kind of where my career started. I played Tweener on the hit Fox TV show for the first 2 years, and that kind of started my career. And then did Shooter with Mark Wahlberg and Bonnie and Clyde, and then Roots, and my last film that I'm the most proud of, which is not Camp X-Ray. I was in that too with Kristen Stewart, but I was The Iron Orchard, which is the film coming out August 6th. We had a theatrical run early this spring that was amazing. It won a bunch of awards around the world, and it's just an incredible movie. And so those are some of the places you might see me there, or 7-Eleven or the gas station, get my morning coffee. Yeah. I'm still a gas station coffee drinker. I haven't
really
been in Starbucks yet. Yeah, so
wow, that's,
you know,
gross.
I like my coffee black.
Boy, and 2 days old.
Yeah, I know.
Now on Prison Break, because I was thinking about that when I first saw your photos, and I was like, this guy, does he really looks familiar? And I was trying to place you, and then when Prison Break showed up, I was like, hold on. Were you the guy? And I'm just going to be blunt, and I apologize if I offend you. Were you were like the bitch, right?
I was the guy that was raped by Avocado, and then I sliced his thing off with a razor blade. So I was the snitch in the group, and who ratted on the guys for a cheeseburger. I played Tweener, and then I escaped with the crew, and Wentworth says, I know you snitched on us and set me on my own path as the feds hunt me down. And then Mahone finally kills me in the end, the FBI. You know, the funny thing about that is it's my oldest role, and obviously was a breaking role for me.
Sure.
But there's not a day that goes by that someone doesn't stop me about Prison Break. In fact, I live in a little small town in Texas.
Yeah.
And outside of Austin, and I'm originally from Texas, and I'm at my grocery store a few weeks back, and the lady ringing up my groceries was like, have you ever seen Prison Break? And you look just like the guy that played Tweener. And I said, I am. And she's like, no. She wouldn't believe me. I was like, what are you doing at an HEB grocery store in Hutto, Texas? So there's not a day that goes by. People don't stop me on that.
And, oh, my God. That's
just
awesome.
It's kind of right when TV got good. It was 24, Prison Break, Lost. before Netflix, before Hulu, Amazon, all these streaming services.
Yep.
And now, you know, it was kind of back then, like, oh, you do TV. And now okay. everybody wants to do TV.
Sure.
And so it was a great thing for me.
So how was that for you? Like, because you were on the show for, what was it, was two seasons, you said?
For 2 years, yeah.
So how was it for you when you got to that point where you found out that they were going to kill you off? Was that kind of a bummer, or were you prepared for it?
No, I wasn't. And, you know, I had, they actually made me a series regular offer, and I was a young man mm-hmm. who listened to agents who will remain nameless, who sure. are no longer in the business, thank God for young actors.
Right.
But, you know, I listened to all of them saying, oh, the money's too low, and, you know, you're going to go do this movie with Wahlberg, and you're going to be a movie star, right. and you don't need that. Just don't sign the contract. And so I didn't sign the contract, and I showed up to work, and I started reading the script, and it was like tweener, shot, dead, killed it. And I ran into the producers. I was like, what is this? And they said, well, you didn't sign your contract, and the studio's pissed off, so you're dead.
Oh, no.
And huge mistake. I mean, a lot of money gone and thrown out the window there. But more importantly, you know, as an actor, it's like, take that steady work, you know, a bird in the hand. Yeah. So for me, it was bittersweet because I did not want to leave. It was a great job for me. It was a number one show on TV.
Wow.
And it really affected me, not just career wise, but it affected my life. I felt like I was never going to work again and regroup. Right. And obviously that wasn't the case, but, you know, when I went through my own struggles post that, sure. and I was lucky enough to bounce back and get a second chance at everything.
Right.
And Bonnie and Clyde kind of set me back in motion.
No, when was Bonnie and Clyde? Was that, what,
2013? 2013, Emile Hirsch, William Hurt.
Yes.
Holliday Grainger. And was nominated for an Emmy and Critics' Choice Award. And I worked with Bruce Beresford, who did Driving Miss Daisy, Tender Mercies, just awesome director and a great man. And from there, we had this working relationship, and he called me up and said, Lane, I've got this role for you, a real nasty bugger. And have you ever heard of Roots? And I was like, of course I've heard of Roots. They're redoing it?
Yeah.
He said, yeah. And I'm thinking, I'm a white guy in Roots. I'm going to be not the nicest of guys. And I played that role. And that, I don't know if you've gotten a chance to see it, but the remake, it was incredible. All four nights were just spectacular. It really was a film. It was filmmaking.
Yeah.
And from there, I got nominated for a Critics' Choice Award.
I know. I saw that.
The Roots role.
And you were nominated against Sterling K. Brown, Frank Langella, Hugh Laurie, John Travolta, and Forest Whitaker. Did that blow your mind a little bit? That's kind of crazy company.
I was on set actually in Savannah, Georgia, and my buddy called me in the morning, and this was for a film I wrote called The Divorce Party. And he called me and said, congratulations. I said, congratulations for what? He said, for your nomination. And I said, nominated for what? I couldn't even remember. He said, oh, for Roots. And I looked up the list. I was like, oh, I'll never win that. But I was so honored to be nominated. With that caliber, I was like, John Travolta, Forest Whitaker, what's my name doing on here?
That's amazing.
For any young actor that listens in or a filmmaker, you know, I always tell my friends and people that want to get in the business, savor the victories, because there's so much rejection and you hear no so many times, you know, that when you do hear a yes, even if it's a small role, be excited about it and savor the victories, just because, you know, there's only a few people that somehow fate has landed them in an Oscar winning role and they get that statue. And and you don't, you know, that's not everybody's plight, but to be a great storyteller all around, you know, savor those moments. And for me, I've really learned to enjoy that.
That's awesome.
When things like Roots come up. And yeah, it was cool.
And I remember hearing about it when it came, when they were promoting it, and I thought, wow, that's a bold move to try and remake Roots. And I didn't get to see it. Now I want to see it, but I was like, wow, to me that seemed like a big risk.
Yeah, it did, and it seemed risky. I'd had that conversation before with Beresford about, man, you're going to remake Bonnie and Clyde, and now you're going to redo Roots.
Wow.
And it did, but the story was, even though it was relatively the same plight of these characters and how they ended up,
right.
Roots, definitely the script was a lot different than the original. And I think all the actors in it just brought phenomenal performances. The directors were incredible. I'm a big history buff, and
excellent.
I always have been since I was a kid. So it's kind of cool that I keep getting these pieces from back in the day. And
yeah.
Even The Iron Orchard is a book set in the late 30s, early 40s. And I guess the period piece, my next film, 12 Mighty Orphans, also a period piece, late 30s, early 40s. So something in that and going back in time speaks to me, and I'm excited that I tell those stories.
You know what? We don't even have to talk acting anymore. Forget it. I'm going to save it for Ned Van Zandt. You and I are going to talk about Needlepoint and Baked Goods. How about that?
Go for it. Anything, man. I'm always game. You know, it's funny you say that, because when we were doing the not Bonnie and Clyde, the Iron Orchard press tour, we'd go to all these theaters across the state, and I'd meet with the audience, and I got it down so much that you didn't need to do a Q&A after the film, because I was like, I know the bullet points, man. I can do this.
Right.
So sometimes, you know, when you get an interview, you feel like it is sure. that, and I would prefer, you want to talk football? I can talk football with you all day long.
I wish, you know what I want to talk to you about? There are a few things. One, so you live in Austin, just outside of Austin?
Yes, sir.
What a great city.
Basically.
You keep calling me sir. You make me feel like an old man. That's going to be the thing that I'm going to hang up on you.
Okay. Well, you know, down south, everybody's sir. You want to talk about, you know, real life and stuff. I was involved in a DUI accident when I was a young man, for drinking and driving, where someone lost their life, and it changed not just everybody's life, and my family, myself, their family, and I went from prison break to prison, and I basically lived my character I was playing. I mean, you talk about a shock therapy, and that's really changed my life and my viewpoint. I'm totally for a lot. Most of my friends drink, and they're fine doing it. I've come to find that I'm not capable of it, and so I just don't do it anymore. And I'm a better guy for it. And my wife thanks me for it too. So
absolutely, I completely understand. And of course, you know, when I was looking stuff up on you, I'm sure Google might be something that you love. You might hate it, because of course you Google your name, and the first thing that comes up is all the stuff that happened that you went through. And so I was, you know, I had that on here. I was going to talk to you about it if you were willing to talk about it. But I mean, I'm sure you've hashed it out so many times that.
Oh, yeah. I'm always open to talk about it. And in fact, I feel like, you know, especially with a lot of young people that I get to share my story with. And in acting, I always kind of say acting and being in movies and stuff kind of only elevates that platform for me to be like, hey man, it can happen in the blink of an eye. I was at a party two blocks from my house. The accident happened one block from my house, 19 minutes of bad decision making and taking a couple shots and drinking. You think you're okay, and everybody's life is changed and shattered. So for me, I talk about it whenever it comes up. I never shy away from it. I was like, hey, I'll tell you, you know, my story and what happened. And I've had so many people come up to me and say, hey, your story inspired my son, my daughter. It inspired me. And so, you know, for me, it's just kind of be brutally honest. And, you know, I always have found that you can make that weakness a strength. And for me, a weakness used to be booze and drinking. And it was a big part of my life, and now it's a strength and a different chapter for me. So I'm a proud, proud sober guy.
That's amazing. That's really amazing. The only reason I was bringing up beer is because Austin has some incredible breweries there, and I'm actually wearing a shirt from Hops and Grain when I was in Austin.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So I'm good. I'm pretty close buddies, and our director's like best friends with him, with Tito. as in Tito's Vodka.
Oh, yeah.
From here.
Yep.
Yeah. He's from Austin. And so I know a lot of these guys. And now there's all these breweries here. And people are making whiskey. Anyway, sure. I let my wife drink the wine. And I'm just the designated driver now.
So since we're talking about the difficult stuff, then I might as well just stay here for a minute. Now, I also read that you lost your parents at a fairly young age.
I did. Yeah. My mom passed away when she was 41.
Okay.
And my dad was 54. He was 10 years older than her. So I lost him inside of 3 years of each other when I was a young man. And that also was a game changer for me. And I think that, you know, they kind of go hand in hand to this drinking issue. I wasn't a big drinker.
Right.
I wasn't a big partier until those moments. And, you know, as a young man, you sometimes you think that you need booze or pills or drugs or whatever to medicate this pain. And that obviously took me down the wrong path. But my father was an artist, an amazing painter. My mother was like a failed musician, amazing pianist. And I always found it interesting that I found the film business because it's kind of like a collaboration of both of them.
Absolutely.
And I definitely use them and their memory in a lot of my work. If you watch my reel, someone said, God, after I watched your reel, I wanted to like commit suicide. I mean, so much drama on it. And, you know, you use what you know and you pull from what you have. And for me, there was a lot of pain and a lot of chapters and a lot of loss and hurt. And, you know, for me, it's just one of those things. I think about them every day.
I was going to ask you about that, like how that has played into your work or how it manifests in your work, because I'm certain that it does. I mean, it's impossible to not have it show up in your work.
Yeah, I mean, I learned early on about sense memory and a lot of stuff stuck with me from that. I kind of took from different acting coaches and teachers along the way. And for me, sense memory and the loss you feel from a parent, I mean, you know, for me, I can tune into anytime there's really an emotional scene and hurt and loss, I just think of them. I literally go to them and it gets me right there. But it's definitely hard. It's something now that I'm a parent.
Right.
I think about even more. I wish they were here to see their grandbaby. And I wish that it also makes me, you know, think I need to do better now that I'm a parent, take better care of my health and but they're definitely a huge part of my work. I didn't get Prison Break till after my dad was passed. So
how did all this even come to be for you? Like, how did this start with you just being an actor, pursuing acting? I mean, aside from your parents both being artists.
Yeah. Well, it actually started for me in high school. Football was my life. Texas high school football, just like Friday nights. I lived it since I was 7 years old. And that was my dream. My dream was I'm going to the NFL, I'm playing ball, and that's what you do.
Wow.
And I was, if we weren't on a football field in the off season, I lived at the movie theater. I thought it was the greatest thing ever. Watching a movie, I still do it today. I sit in the very back row, and I half watch the movie, and I half watch the audience reaction. I just was fascinated that 300 random strangers can laugh and cry together and walk out and be moved. And I was fascinated by it. And I was dared in high school by some guys I played football with to go try out for the musical, the high school musical. And it was for the Chorus Line. And I'll never forget, I got up there and I sang and I tried to dance with the whole thing and I had to act out the scene.
Yep.
And the theater teacher called me up and said, listen, I want to give you the lead part of this, but I can't because you can't dance. And she goes, it's a chorus line. But she goes, boy, you are an actor. You can act your butt off. And she goes, I'm pulling you into the theater club. And so I did. I like lost an elective. I came into the theater club as this big jock.
Oh, my gosh.
And suddenly I found myself, I had to do a monologue for her, and I picked up a chair and smashed it into the wall. I forget what monologue it was, and it scared the whole class. And she called me afterwards. She said, stay here after the class. And I'm like, I'm in trouble. I'm getting kicked out of here. And she said, you are a really gifted actor. And she goes, if you want to pursue this after high school, I know a manager in LA, and I really think you should look him up.
Wow.
And right there, I said, I'm not going to college. I'm not going to go play college football. I'm going to go make movies. And that started me on a flight of, you know, I went out there with $400 and
Damn.
A broken down car and mm-hmm. some clothes on my back, and stayed at a $19 a night motel in Koreatown. You, by the grace of God, it was like that scene in Big where he's big for the first night, and the
yes.
gunshots are going
yes.
off and the sirens, and he's crying himself. But I just felt this gut instinct that I got to go be a storyteller. I got to make movies.
Right.
And you think that you're 18 and reality sets in. And
sure.
once I got there, the manager, of course, was like, oh, you're not an actor. You can be like my assistant's assistant. You know, you've got no talent, kid. And it was like my world was shattered. But, you know, that was the first real rejection. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I wore it with a badge of honor. Like, no one's going to tell me I can't make movies. Now, I didn't know a soul out there. And so I worked every job under the sun.
Yep.
And my car broke down. I used to take the bus at 4 a.m. to go work at this gym on the 5 a.m. to noon schedule to go to acting class. And then I started writing movies. I go, I'm going to break into this business because people need material. And then I sold my first project to Madonna, of all people, and got a studio deal at MGM when I was 21.
Oh, my God.
So that broke me into the business. I broke into the business as a writer before I was ever an actor. And then I finally got to tell my writing agent, I want to be an actor. I'm just writing so I can act.
What was the project that you sold to Madonna?
It was called Chasing Fate. They never made the movie. It was like the romantic comedy era.
Sure.
And and I wrote that. And then I got a deal with MGM to write a movie called Succubus,
gosh.
A horror yes. Marvel character. And so that kind of set me, that gave me an agent and set me on my way. And so now it just stuck with me. Every time I act after I'm done doing something, I write one because job security.
Yeah. Well, so did you land Prison Break when you were in L.A.?
I landed Prison Break when I was in L.A., yes.
So then that brought you back to Texas.
And that brought me back to Texas, yeah.
Crazy.
Which was a trip. I was coming home and that's a good lesson too, because everybody said, you can't move to California. You got to go to college. You're out of your mind. And I followed my gut, my heart, and it brought me back. And it was never like a see what I did, guys. You know, it was more like a look, man, if you follow your heart and you work really hard, you can make this happen. So it was a cool feeling to come back home.
That is really, really amazing. So you also told me in one of your emails that you lived out there for 20 years. You're back in Texas now. Obviously, you don't feel the need to be there. Do you think you don't feel that it's necessary for you to have to live there? Or do you feel like you're missing out on opportunities because you're not there? Are you making any compromises?
No, not at all. I feel like, in fact, I've got more opportunities. And for anyone that wants to be in the business, the technology's changed.
Sure.
I mean, look what we're doing now. We're Skyping and talking over a computer. I've done that with plenty of directors and meetings. And you can write from anywhere. The equipment is available. You can put, you know, kids that want to make a movie, go make a movie. You can get the gear together. You can raise financing anywhere. You can write a script anywhere. You can tell good stories. And there's so many outlets when you're done with your film to send it to that you don't have to be in LA anymore. I mean, you can be Georgia, Louisiana, New Mexico, Texas, all the way up to New York. Oklahoma's got huge tax incentives now.
Wow.
And it's really about what works for you and where you want to be. I mean, some people want to be out there. And for me, that's just not who I am. And I love my business. I love making movies. I just Hollywood for general was not for me. I lived there for 20 years. I never called it home, which I found weird. So luckily my wife was smart enough to say, hey, let's go to Texas and raise our daughter and not live here. And I was like, I'm on board.
But do you feel though that you, it was necessary for you to at least spend a little bit of time there to establish yourself within the industry?
Remember, I'm going to age myself for a second, but this is 1998 when I moved out there. I mean, there was no, let me connect on my cell phone and get on the web. You know, you're using like a Thomas guide.
Thomas guide. Yes.
Old flip phone. Yeah. Thomas guide. So back then I needed to be there because you would literally physically have to walk in with a headshot and a resume and meet people in person. And nowadays you don't have to do that. Now, some agencies will call you out there and you might need to go for some meetings, but you literally do not have to be there.
More with Lane Garrison in just a minute. You're listening to You May Have Seen, proud member of the Queen City Podcast Network, powered by Ortho Carolina. There are so many great podcasts on the network, and they're adding new ones all the time, showcasing great stories by great people and shining a spotlight on the Queen City. You can find them all at queencitypodcastnetwork.com. Shoutouts! I've got a personal attachment to the shoutouts this week. HBO re-released their series From the Earth to the Moon, which I was in back in 1998. I started watching it again. It's amazing! It's been great to relive that whole experience all over again. 12 episodes, different cast for practically every episode, loaded with You May Have Seens, so I'm going to shout out a few. Here we go. Kieran Mulrooney. I know you know this guy. One, he's Dermot Mulrooney's brother. You may have seen him on Seinfeld in the You Double Dip the Chip episode. He was the Double Dip the Chip guy. He plays Rusty Schweikert in From the Earth to the Moon. Kieran and I actually worked on another movie together called Morning a few years later, so that was a great connection to make. Tammy Arnold. She plays Sarah in an episode of From the Earth to the Moon. You may have seen Tammy on the show Mr. Mercedes as Nurse Wilmer and Homeland as Senator Jocelyn Cates. Oh yeah, one more. Rick Reitz. He plays reporter number 8. How crazy is that? Number 8. You may have also seen Rick in The Last Full Measure with Samuel L. Jackson and on the sci-fi series Superstition as Mayor Bickley. So many amazing people in From the Earth to the Moon. Go check it out. You'll see me in episode 5. It's crazy to watch. I look like I'm 13. Okay, You May Have Seen is going to be taking a little break for a couple of weeks, so stay tuned for what's next. I want to thank everyone who's been listening to the podcast. I'm incredibly grateful. Wouldn't be doing this without all of you. So thank you a million times, thank you. Okay, here's more with Lane Garrison.
We've talked a little bit about you being a dad. Now let's talk about how that is now affecting you as an actor. Or is it? I mean, is it making you more laid back? Is it changing your priorities? Or are you ready to give the kid away?
Yeah, it's affecting my memory because of my lack of sleep. That's for sure. Someone wrote this to me, I think the day she was born, she said, this will be your greatest production. Yeah, I think for me, it's everything I do now is going to be a reflection, knowing like, hey, my daughter's going to watch this. Is this right. Going to be not just my wife, but daughter? Is this appropriate? Is this what I want to be in this light? And so it does. It affects my decision making. My work ethic, I think, has increased tenfold just really? Because now I know it is. It's no longer the Lane show. It's more right. Like you have these mouths to feed. You take care. You make sure this girl can go to college. So yep. I thought I used to work hard. I was like a 5 a.m. up at the gym. I write movies. I read all the trades. I was BSing. This is the hardest work I've ever done is raising this little girl. So it's a great thing for me. And yeah, I love it. I hope she doesn't want to be an actress, though.
So I'm looking through the press stuff that you sent me, and of course, I couldn't help but notice these wonderful photos of you shirtless in a pair of jeans splashing around at the beach.
Oh, yeah.
What's that all
about? The Abercrombie ad.
Is that what that was?
I forget what it was. It was literally like there was a publicist on set, my publicist at the time, who it was at the end of the day, the shoot, she was like, you know those Abercrombie ads where they do it? And I was literally doing it playfully. Like, I was, like, running through the water. And we were doing it as a spoof. And, of course, those are photos that are used that are, like, by the way, and having a baby and, you know, putting on a few pounds, I would gladly get back to that shirtless model day on the beach. Yeah.
I was going to say, have you had to do that on a semi-regular basis? Is that a part of what you have to do as a leading man in the Hollywood world is, you know, Oh, look at me. And how weird is that?
Yeah, it is pretty true, though. I think for leading man quality, they want to see the whole quote-unquote package,
right,
literally.
Right.
But I always joke with my former writing partner, and he's an actor too. I said, wouldn't it be great if I just ate cheeseburgers every day and I was really funny character actor, like the best job in the game.
Right.
Like I don't need to run 15 miles a week and do all of this. But yeah, if you want to be in that leading man category, I think, you know, you got to do everything you can to present yourself physically, sure, mental capability, everything. Even my wife laughs at those photos. So
that's awesome.
She's like, yeah, right.
That is fantastic. So now I also read somewhere that you play golf.
Oh yeah. If I die today,
yep,
and I go to heaven and God says, what do you want to go back as? I am 100% saying a pro golfer.
Really?
I'm an addict. I am self-taught, and I'm proud to say I am a scratch golfer, self-taught.
Get out of town.
That's my one serenity and peace of mind. I go to the driving range like every other day, and I go out there and just collect my thoughts and hit balls and train. And that's my. See, I'm so addicted that I told my cousin if it's below 106 degrees, I'm going to go out there. It doesn't matter. I'm literally diehard. I'll be the only one out there. And, you know, I love the game because, and you know the game too.
Yep.
It is a lot like acting. If you think about it, when you do a scene or you're breaking down a scene, you're thinking, what time of year is it? Where am I? Who are these people? What is my motivation? Where am I at emotionally? And you ask yourself, right?
Yep.
20 different things.
Yep.
Before I hit that shot on the golf course, where's the wind? Where's the flag? What's my lie? What club do I need? It's the same mindset. So that's why I really like it too.
That's really cool.
It gets me in that groove.
That's a neat way of looking at it. That's pretty spot on. Do you watch it as well? Do you follow the professional sport?
I follow golf.
Yeah.
I follow football. I play baseball. I don't follow it too much.
Right.
Just because the season's too long. Love playing basketball. Don't follow it. But for me, it's golf and football, really. That's my thing.
So talk to me about this little movie called The Iron Orchard. I did that on purpose. Have you had people say things like that to you? Like, oh, I saw that little movie that you're in.
No. If anything, they say that film was incredible and they think it's this $30 million studio epic.
That's fantastic.
That was made literally on, I mean, it was, you know, in fact, we had lost a couple film festivals this past year.
Yeah.
And the jury came up to us and said, y'all's film was the best film in this whole thing. But we didn't feel right giving the award to a big budget feature.
Oh, sweet Jesus.
And our producer, Camille, our mutual friend,
yep,
literally lost her mind and said, what are you talking about? This is a true indie. We made this on a shoestring budget. And it is literally, not just for me as an actor, but being a part of this process and helping put the movie together as well. I've never been more proud to be part of something in my life. And, you know, we could literally write a book on how to do a period piece epic on a Clerks shoestring budget. You know, I can't say the exact budget, but we'll just say it was pennies on the dollar. But we made it in 24 days.
Wow.
And so that makes it even more special because everyone in Hollywood said, you guys can't do this. You don't have the money. You don't have the days. Mm-hmm. It won't be done. They were all naysayers, every agent, every manager.
Right.
And then, in fact, I showed it to my managers afterwards, and they're like, how did you do this? How?
That's awesome.
This is incredible.
That is awesome.
So I'm so proud. I'm proud of it. It's based on a book of the same name that was published in 1966, mm-hmm, that co-won the Texas Book of Letters Award with The Last Picture Show. And they were trying to make this movie for 50 plus years. Clint Eastwood, Paul Newman, Elvis
that.
Presley, George Bacall.
Oh my God, Presley. Wow.
The list goes on and on. And they couldn't crack the script.
Wow.
And luckily, Ty Roberts and Jerry De Leon finally cracked the script. I read it, and on page one, I was like, I'm in. I didn't even know it was a book.
Right.
It just described West Texas oil fields so well. I was like, this is beautiful writing. I'm in. Really, it was a cool experience because people that owned ranches and oil wells and old cars, it was like a whole town came together to make this movie.
That's fantastic.
And donated and put time and money and effort into it. And that made it even more special. But I have yet to have anybody come up and say that movie was terrible or it was garbage outside of the New York Times, which, you know, it's funny. They called it a movie. It was toxic masculinity to them. And they also said that it was just a bunch of white guys trying to destroy the earth, punching holes in the ground. And I'm like, they completely missed the point of this movie. But, you know, that's to be said about the quote-unquote critics.
Gotcha.
It's just a beautiful, beautiful film.
I mean, I'm very excited for you guys and for her. Camille is truly, she's a very close, wonderful, dear friend to me. So I'm so excited that the movie has done so well and it's had the success that it's had. For everybody listening, I am talking to Lane Garrison, who you might remember from Prison Break, Shooter, the movie Crazy, the TV series The Event, The Devil's in the Details, Bonnie and Clyde, From Dusk Till Dawn, the series, Better Call Saul, NCIS, Camp X-Ray with Kristen Stewart, which went to Sundance in 2014, and the movie The Iron Orchard, as well as the remake of the miniseries Roots, where he was nominated for a Critics' Choice Award. How crazy is that? And two other films that he co-wrote, The Divorce Party and Spy Intervention. Now, I noticed, Lane, as I was going through your stuff, that you've played a lot of detectives, cops, military-type guys, and you've had some really, really great roles, but they've been more on the supporting side. The fact that you are the lead of The Iron Orchard, did that create a new opportunity for you as an actor?
Yeah, I would say first it was the hardest work of my life. I mean, you know, my hat's off to a lot of these big movie stars that are number one on the call sheet, because you really are, you're carrying the picture on your back, and there's a lot of pressure that comes with that. For me, it was the hardest work of my life, the most challenging, because we couldn't shoot in order. It wasn't like we were in, and this covers about 20 years of this man's life and every emotion under the sun. So I really, it was a test to be like, okay, all the years of prep, are you ready? And I'm proud to say, and you know, I say this with no ego, that I am ready to be one on the call sheet. I love that pressure now. This movie taught me that. And it was a huge stepping stone and a milestone for me. I mean, if I never acted another day in my life,
knowing that this
would be a grand slam for me. So I'm so proud of it. And, you know, we're talking about this film, and I wanted to go back to Camille really quickly. This is our good friend who produced it, on Orchard. Just to tell you where our budget was, Camille knocked on my hotel. We were in Big Spring, Texas, and said, get up. I need, you know, Camille's, I need you right now. I need you to get like a signed picture. You got a Prison Break memorabilia? I was like, what? Yeah, it's in my folder. Get up right now, sign this thing. And she drug me across the street to this place called Parks Fuel.
Okay.
And she said, we need a place to park all these cars, and our gas card was stolen, or all our gas out of our vehicles had been siphoned the night before, and we're running out of money. And she goes, we need help from this man, Bob Parks. So she storms into this office and she says, where's Bob? Where's Bob at? Hi, I'm Camille Chambers. I'm producer of An Ultra. Starts speaking 100 miles an hour. You know how she does.
Oh, yeah.
And he said, well, slow down a minute. Why don't you come back to my office and explain to me what's going on? So 5 minutes later, she's told my whole life story. She said what we're doing there. He knows the book. And she said, she just puts her hands on her hips and says, I'm not leaving this office till you write me a check for $25,000 so we can finish getting this movie made. And he did. And he did. He wrote the check. And I couldn't believe it. I was like, and she did that a number of times. And just how she worked it, and that's just Camille.
She's so charming and so likable. I mean, I don't have $25,000, and I'd find a way to give it to her if I had to.
Yeah, I know. I think he just wrote it to get her out of the office, but right. Yeah.
Talk to me more about when you were working on The Iron Orchard as the lead, as the number one on the call sheet. Like, how much different was the workload for you in comparison to other films and other jobs that you've been on as more of a supportive player?
Yeah, okay. So I shot all 24 days, mm-hmm. and every day from morning to, you know, close to 14, 16-hour days. The thing that was the most difficult with this shoot was 80%, and when you see the film, you'll understand, 80% of it is exterior shots. Right. Well, we shot Midland, Odessa, and Big Spring, Gale, out in West Texas in the middle of July. Wow. It was 114 degrees, 17 straight days.
Oh, my God.
My hat's off to this crew. Mm-hmm. We had two people drop like flies the first 2 days just from heat exhaustion.
Sure.
So it was mentally just getting through the heat was one part of it. But the second part is, like I said, we're covering a span of a man's life.
Right.
And we can't shoot in sequential order. So we're bouncing around from I'm a young man to I'm a middle-aged man to I'm a guy in a fat suit and gray hair.
Oh, wow.
And it would literally be like quick changes out in the pavement where you're sweating 114 degrees. And you'd get one or two takes.
Wow.
Because we didn't have the money and we didn't have the time. So that meant, for me, that just increased the pressure even more to know where I was emotionally, mm-hmm. and to make sure I was 100% in that world. It was get up at 4:30 in the morning, prepare, get the set, make sure you're prepared, and know, map out where you're going, because it would be, like I said, and when you see the film, you'll really understand what I'm saying. But for me, you know, you were really lucky if you got three takes, so you better be on your A game.
Absolutely.
And that's why our director even said, watching you, it's like watching a one-man play or something. The quick changes and the change in attitude, the change in your voice, the alcoholism and fueled in you and the rage. And, you know, because really he goes from a young man to a person scorned, mm-hmm. To, you know, it's really watching the plight of Jim McNeely from a young boy who's bright-eyed and bushy-tailed with dreams and hopes and promises,
sure.
to a man that has destroyed that existence. And so for me, it was great. Those supporting roles definitely, they all led up to that moment.
What's it going to take, do you think, or you may not even have an answer for that, to push you into that next level? Because obviously you've had some great opportunities, some real high-profile stuff. Like we said, you got nominated for a Critics' Choice Award, and now you had your first true leading role in a feature film. And I'm sure, with as much time and as many years as you've put into this, you want to take this as far as it can go. So what do you think is going to push you through?
Well, it's hard because you really need, I hope with this coming back out August 6th and it going wide that more people see that. And I hope that maybe this thing, it already feels like it's been a big victory in itself. But I really think the biggest thing in actors, and we're all pursuing this same thing of the only reason for me, I would want to be a quote unquote movie star is work, job security, right? I want to keep working and keep doing what I love. And to become that means I need a film that's distributed from 2,500 to 4,000 screens,
right.
that crosses that 100 million mark. That's just a phenomenon. Mm-hmm. So we all know that's like winning the lottery.
Sure.
This will definitely get the attention of a lot of other directors, mm-hmm. and filmmakers. You know, we hope that it just always sticks around and that more people will see it. And that's really what it needs. It's just kind of like another resume call saying, hey, let's get Lane for that role. He's right. capable of doing it and being number one on the call sheet.
Yeah.
It's hard because, look, 20 years. That role was 20 years of preparation. You know, and I always say, I always learned early on, right? There's no small parts. There's only small actors.
Absolutely.
Every part, man, every part in that film meant something to me. And when I watch it, just every performance, it could just be one. My favorite scene in the movie, the guy had one scene. That was it. And it was scene stealing.
That's my life.
You know,
that there is you go. My life. Or just coming in from one scene and trying to do your best work and show your chops in that, you know, short amount of time that you've got, and hoping that somebody remembers and says, hey, I want that guy. Or we want to use him for something else, for sure.
It's kind of sad where our business has gone now, because it used to be, when I started, it was a business, and especially on the agency side, of people that love to discover talent and love to break new talent and love to push you into that stratosphere. And now it's a very safe playing field where nobody wants to make a rash decision. And so I think for filmmakers and young actors, get out there and make your own movie, because you really got to pave your own way, make your own hit movie, you know, and then you really hope that it leads to that next level. But nowadays there's only a handful of movie stars really left that draw big numbers. Writing and understanding the writer's motivation only helps you as an actor. So for me, I just wrote the book adaptation for 12 Mighty Orphans with my director of the Iron Orchard, Ty Roberts. He and I wrote the script together based on the Jim Dent novel. And that starts filming in September. Wow. Now, I won't be the lead of that because of what we're talking about now, because we need the Iron Orchard. It's a, you know, $10 to $12 million film.
Yeah.
And, you know, those investors want, like we talk about, a sure bet. They want to know that, hey, Keanu Reeves is going to do this or whatever, that's going to give me that $10 million back, which I get. But the writing always, it always helps.
Now, given where we started when we started talking in the interview, and everything that you've been through and where you are now, would you say that you are a comeback story, or are you more of a story of perseverance?
A little bit of both. I don't think it's comeback, honestly. Now that I've never been asked that before, but by the way, I think it's perseverance in my life in general, because there were so many times where I felt like I could just tap out here through pain and struggle, that I think that everybody thought I was, you know, when my parents had left and this world, I thought that was a time to check out. And, you know, when the accident happened, I felt like that was a time to check out. Or even before that, trying to get a career in a business that, you know, I was an outsider, that seemed like a time to give up. So it was just really about believing in myself that, you know, I can do this, and no one was going to tell me no. And just keep persevering and keep going with a positive attitude. And that really brought me back. Now, obviously, there was a lot of people that gave me a second chance after the accident and stuff with the Bonnie and Clyde. But I had to persevere in that moment and convince people that I can do this. Again, you know, don't count me out. You know, I'll wear my heart on my sleeve and try to make amends. And it was just perseverance. And even now, with this film, it's really perseverance, because it's doing everything you can to get it out there and work. I did about 32 Q&As. And that's still going to keep going. And that's just me wanting to get out and meet the fans and meet people and do the extra work.
Right.
And that's just about perseverance. So for anyone listening to this, I think whether you're actor, writer, producer, director, if you're just an entrepreneur, just persevere and do not listen to the naysayers and the no's. Just see your vision and get after it.
Well, Lane, I think you have done an amazing, amazing job. I'm so glad that I've had the chance to talk with you and officially meet you. And I hope this isn't the last time we get to talk. I really look forward to seeing more of your work. Your story is incredible, and I really, really appreciate you taking the time to sit down with me. This has been You May Have Seen with Lane Garrison. Thanks so much for listening.
Oh, man. Thanks for having me, man. That was awesome.
Follow us on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. And if you'd like to leave a comment or review, that's always nice. You can also email us at youmayhaveseen@gmail.com if you have a comment or a question, and we'll give you a shout-out in the next episode.